You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, today's agenda setter is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, of course, will be talking Egypt. He'll be asking what happens now to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Plus, after 20 years in charge, the King of Belgium is getting off the throne. Does his abdication have anything to do with the mysterious paternity case going through the Belgian courts?
And placemaking, 40 years on, we'll be asking one of the biggest proponents of the theory to explain how architects' drawings become the places we live.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Also on the program, we're in Brazil to ditch the flip-flops and board shorts for some haute couture.
The competition is global, even if you are just selling it internally. So if they are not able to compete in a global sense, they're going to be swallowed by Prada's and the Uniqlo's and the high street and the fast fashion and the luxury brands that are coming to Brazil.
All of that. Plus, we will play some music too, of course. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been ousted by the army and is being detained in a military facility in Cairo. In a televised announcement, the head of the army said Morsi had failed to meet the demands of the Egyptian people. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said the constitution has been suspended and Mr. Morsi's powers will be taken over by the Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court. It was later announced that the leader and deputy leader of the Muslim Brotherhood's political wing had been arrested. US State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki says the US is keeping a close eye on developments in Egypt.
We believe all sides need to take steps to talk with each other, to engage with each other, to lower the level of violence and call for an end to the violence. And we're hopeful that that is something that can happen.
The White House says President Obama and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel have agreed to hold a high-level meeting on allegations that the US has spied on its European allies. In a statement, the White House said the two leaders had spoken on the phone and that the president had assured Chancellor Merkel that the United States takes seriously the concerns of its European allies and partners. It added that US and EU officials could discuss intelligence and privacy issues as early as next Monday. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, has arrived back in his country after his presidential plane was diverted to Austria due to rumors that he had the American whistleblower Edward Snowden on board. Addressing a crowd of supporters at El Alto International Airport, Mr. Morales said it had been an open provocation towards the continent and that North American imperialism uses its people to terrify and intimidate. Filipino activists in the capital Manila have marched on the US embassy to show their opposition to plans to grant American troops access to a proposed new naval base. The military is planning to build new air and naval bases at a former US base to allow America to keep a close eye on Chinese military movements in the region. The new Patriotic Alliance says the relation between America and the Philippines is one-sided and that visits by the US military undermine Philippine sovereignty. Renato Reyes is the alliance's Secretary General.
This is a big betrayal, considering that in 1991 the Philippines already decided to reject a new bases treaty. Now they're trying to reverse that decision and allowing more ships to come in, disguised as access arrangements, but in reality, these facilities would become de facto U.S. military bases.
News Corp has defended its boss, Rupert Murdoch, following the release of a secret recording in which he criticises the British police inquiry into allegations of phone hacking by journalists. In the recording, made in March, Murdoch is heard complaining to Sun journalists about totally incompetent police officers. He describes the inquiry as a disgrace and says he'll give total support to journalists even if they're convicted, saying they're innocent until proven guilty. In a statement, News Corp said Mr. Murdoch had shown understandable empathy with his staff. Authorities in Peru have brought criminal charges against developers who destroyed an ancient pyramid at an archaeological site near the capital, Lima. The building, which was one of 12 at the El Paraiso complex, was thought to be around 4,000 years old. Two property companies are accused of tearing down the 20-foot-high monument. And the reigning hot dog eating champions are preparing to defend their crowns at the annual Nathan's Famous 4th of July International Hot Dog Eating Contest in New York City. Sonia the Black Widow Thomas holds the women's world record, having eaten 45 hot dogs and buns. The reigning six-time hot dog eating world champion Joey Chestnut will try to break his own record of 68 hot dogs and buns within 10 minutes. He's also seeking to set a world record of 7 straight hot dog eating wins, but both say there's far more to them than just hot dogs.
72 ounces of steak in 8 minutes, 47 grilled cheese sandwiches in 10 minutes, 10 pounds of rib meat in 10 minutes, 103 Crystal hamburgers in 8. I love to eat. I love competition. I really lucked out with this career.
Hot dog is my first title, and then I do have an oyster title. I have 47 dozen oysters in 8 minutes, and then about 181 chicken wings in 12 minutes, and I have about 40 world record.
No one-trick ponies, those two, then. I wonder how many ponies they've eaten. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
The weird thing, Barney, about Joey Chestnut and his speed eating is that if you put his name into a search engine, you know that predictive thing where it comes up with the things other people are searching for in relation to it? Joey Chestnut, the third one is training tips. training tip. I mean, isn't what his whole thing is? It's the reverse of training constantly. He's untraining himself.
He must produce a workout video, surely.
But to be fair, Dominic, you were saying off air that you actually flew to LA to meet Joey Chestnut and you actually got trained yourself.
On. I mean, there's off air and there's on air, Phil, and that's why
what
the lights
goes on tour
sometimes.
Stays on tour.
That's it. If anyone does want a tip, though, don't worry about a one day splurge, says Joey. Your body can recover from all sorts of things and start with the less fattening dishes. Thanks very much, Joey Chestnut.
I'll just go and have a glass of water then.
Barney will be back. Possibly with more speed eating news just before 8:30. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
And yes, indeed, you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and the hot dog eating champion, Dominic Reynolds. Well, perhaps soon to be. It's 7 minutes past the hour here in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda. Joining us live here in the studio is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, welcome to the program. There's only really one story we can talk about there, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's what is going to happen in Egypt today after yesterday's, you know, historic and tumultuous events. And the two things that I'm really going to be looking at is what happens to the arrested Muslim Brotherhood figures and what happens to the Muslim Brotherhood aligned media organizations. Are they going to be kept closed? And how is this crackdown going to continue? And then secondly, is how are the there have been rumors going around that the pro-Morsi protests that are opposing what they're calling as just a full-blown coup, whether the military is going to try to clear them out by force. There were some unconfirmed fighting at one of these protests a couple of hours ago, but I haven't seen exactly what happened confirmed. But the kind of the backlash against the Muslim Brotherhood, how that continues, it, I think, is the most important thing to look at today.
Okay, and so well, let's look at the Brotherhood then. Obviously, this unparalleled period of power for them. I'm sure they imagined it would last longer than a year, but it's over now. And I guess the question is, whatever the shape of the future of Egypt, what place does the Brotherhood have in it? And I presume there is a danger then of the Brotherhood being pushed underground.
Well, a lot of people are talking about this, but I find the idea that the Brotherhood are going to be completely excised from Egyptian, kind of formal Egyptian politics and formal Egyptian society quite difficult to work out how that would happen. I mean, they've got a very, you know, they're the biggest organization in Egypt. They've got a very large base of support. I mean, they don't have the majority, and there are clearly a lot of people who supported them a year ago who violently oppose them now. But the idea that they could just be kind of forced on the ground would require the kind of level of heavy authoritarianism which are associated with Egypt's last three dictatorial presidents. And I think the idea that the revolutionaries themselves or the international community would put up with that kind of really, really egregious abuses of human rights, I find difficult to comprehend.
It's also interesting to note that the Egyptian army has had a very difficult and fractious relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. They weren't too impressed when they came to power a year ago, but obviously, you know, they kept with it. Are you getting the sense that some people are saying the army is getting their... a bit of revenge because they came to power a year ago?
Well, I mean, the military, I think, was pretty upset with what happened last November, where Morsi claimed additional powers, which is part, I mean, it's the irony is part of his downfall and part of the reason why a lot of secular and liberal protesters and revolutionaries oppose him is he claimed additional powers and he used those additional powers to remove the military top brass who had been trying to run the country and stifle the transition. So that's the first irony of it, is the act which was in some way solidifying the revolution and clearing out the old regime to an extent undermined him in the eyes of large sections of the population who also were revolutionary and opposed the old regime. But the second irony is the guy that he brought in when he got rid of Mubarak's defense minister, who had been running the Tantawi, who had been running the country in the transition. The guy he brought in, al-Sisi, is the who was meant to be the kind of great, younger, very religiously minded, pious general who understood the ideas of the revolution and also understood the ideas of the Brotherhood. It's him who has removed Morsi. And it's difficult to think that Sisi and the military haven't been planning this for some time. From all the reports so far, it seems to be pretty well coordinated, pretty well planned. So it looks like they were perhaps waiting for an opportunity that they could do this.
One of the things that I suppose is interesting to think about now is that part of the reason that the Muslim Brotherhood became the force that it did, sort of 18 months ago, was its organisational strength. And lots of commentators have said that organisational strength is down to the fact that there was a single idea, effectively, that no other political force had this kind of unifying kind of force, a centrifugal force politically bringing people towards it. That sort of stage has moved on. So what point politically can people rally around? And, you know, for the non-Muslim Brotherhood political landscape, what kind of forces can they use to bring together in the same way that the Brotherhood did?
So it's interesting how the Brotherhood operated and continues to operate in a rather different way from the protesters. Both are able to bring large numbers of people on the streets and large number of support, but in a very different way. So the Brotherhood is an organization which is pretty embedded into most sections of Egyptian society. It plays a day-to-day role. It provides services. It is very firmly part of the day-to-day normal reality for a lot of Egyptians. The big protests that you're seeing on Tahrir Square are these mass experiments with direct democracy, with attempts to genuinely create the people's will, and that's much more difficult to institutionalize, which is why the revolution has not really produced any new political parties, any new sort of revolutionary institutions that have been thus far integrated with the state. So the real challenge, I think, for those forces that have removed Morsi that aren't the military, the protests and the rebellion movement, is for them to, one, work out a consensual enough way between them that they can work out, because really what Egypt needs to do now is set the rules of the game. No one has set the rules of the game. They need to agree commonly what are the basic outline of Egypt's economy, society, and politics. What is that going to be? And that I don't think that the kind of fetishization of elections is actually necessarily that helpful for that, because it needs to be a consensual process.
Well, going forward, just off of Dom's point there, the Muslim Brotherhood
18 months ago, ran on a message of providing bread and water, the basic services that Egyptians needed. Obviously, they weren't able to fulfill on that. But do you think that going forward, the campaigning will still focus on that very same message, providing those very basic services of electricity, food, water, power?
Yes, and you know, the Muslim Brotherhood still has credibility from, you know, providing a lot of social services during the Mubarak era. But you know, one of the three key demands of the revolution initially was bread, and the other two being dignity and social justice. And the last year of Muslim Brotherhood rule has fundamentally failed to deliver that. Economic and social situation has got worse rather than better. And what we've seen is that the Muslim Brotherhood, the revolution was in part a revolution against a particular set of policies, which can be roughly summed up by those that the Brotherhood was bringing in its IMF loan agreement. That was a large part of it. And so their credibility in protecting bread and social justice issues for Egyptians is challenged.
James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, thank you very much as ever for joining us on Midori House.
Lots of unanswered questions still waiting to see. But up next, after this very short break, we'll be talking fashion in Brazil.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, the fashion sector is the second largest industry in Brazil. It employs some 16% of the country's manufacturing workforce, as well as supplying the good citizens of Brazil with bikinis, flip-flops and other sartorial options for the beach. The country is also the world's second largest producer of denim.
Are you a fan of Brazilian fashions?
Yeah, I like... Well, obviously, I'm wearing my denim cutoffs at the moment.
They look
which
good.
I always wear.
And I like
I call
your,
them my radio
I like
cutoffs.
Your, I like your flip-flops.
Thank you very much.
Or as the... the Australians call thongs.
Yeah. And you also like my thong, presumably.
It's a nice thong.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's move on quickly.
Well, Dominic, well, there's a push underway now to promote Brazil's fashion industry abroad. A new program called Ponto Zero, conceived in 2009, is hosting events in London and Paris in the month of July. Well, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Elvisio Miranda Costa, fashion and design director of Abbott, the Brazilian Textile and Apparel Association.
Evelazio, my first question for you is about Ponto Zero program. What is Ponto Zero?
Ponto Zero is an incubator of young up-and-coming designers, which started 5 years ago. Our main goal is that designers, they start that business with a global perspective. Because until up to 20 years ago, Brazil was a very closed country. We didn't have many imports. But now the scene is very different. All the foreign brands are coming to Brazil. And the competition is global, even if you are just selling it internally. So if they don't have a global perspective and if they are not able to compete in a global sense, they're going to be swallowed by Prada's and the Uniqlo's and the high street and the fast fashion and the luxury brands that are coming to Brazil. And also their clients, the Brazilian ones, they're traveling a lot now. So they need to have a global point of view for their collections and their brands. That's what we believe. So we provide them training and mentorship so that they can build a real global business.
How many of them are in the Ponto Zero program?
Now we have 8 designers. Every year we add a few designers and we leave some of them behind either because they're already mature to go on their own.
And can you explain more about those events that you're doing in London and Paris? I mean, is this a way to promote even more Brazilian brands abroad, right?
We always had this in mind, that we needed to give the designers an international experience at some point. In 2008, when we started in partnership with Mercado Mundo Mix, which is like a Brazilian version of Spitalfields Market, something like that, and Casa de Criadores, which is a young designers fashion week, we had this in mind. So we took them first to Portugal, then to Colombia, also Hong Kong and Macau. Our last stop was in New York, so that they can see what's the global fashion market. And that, of course, we can promote Brazilian fashion as a whole, because we find out that new designers, they also carry a freshness with them that reflects on the image of the whole system, of the whole fashion system.
That's what I was going to ask. Do you think the world is interested to see kind of a Brazilian brand abroad? You know, because Brazil usually people associate with positive things, you know, so like the sun, the beaches and everything. How do you think the world is ready?
Yeah, I think when we talk about fashion and fashion people and fashion insiders, Brazilian fashion is not really well known. I mean, for some years we have been known for copying international brands, but this image, I think it's a little bit over now. And yeah, people are more and more looking to Brazil as a consumer market, as a supplier market too. So we need to show what's the real deal about Brazil, and that's what we want to show. It's not only about beaches; it's also about beaches. We love and we have to promote this lifestyle because it's very us. It's very what we are. We're really laid back people and we have a really laid-back lifestyle, and that's what we want to show too. But we also have amazing handmade techniques. We also have people that construct clothes very beautifully and carefully. We also have very good raw materials and people that are very eager to build new business models too, like giving up the old-fashioned way of doing business. So we want to show that too.
And it's worth mentioning as well that the textile industry is the second largest in the country,
sure,
which is huge. So it makes sense as well to promote more abroad. And do you think we have a problem maybe with our high costs? Do you think there's something the government should do to improve that?
Yeah, and Abit works in Brasilia day and night to convince and to try to convince the government to move faster with the public policy towards the fashion segment. We have just made this big breakfast for the senators and all the politicians in Brasilia to show the numbers of the sector. It's a sector that generates lots of jobs, the largest job provider for women in Brazil. It's the largest first employment sector in Brazil when they have their first jobs. Yes, the government has done some stuff for us. The Ministry of Industry and Trade has just launched the Sistema Moda Brasil, like Brazil Fashion System, with a whole menu of activities and politics to foster the fashion sector in terms of training, in terms of taxing. And that's what we need, because in Brazil the tax system is very difficult. Also, we lack a lot of manpower. People are giving up working for the fashion industry and they're starting looking for jobs in the service sectors. A young girl doesn't want to be sewing anymore. She wants to work for telemarketing maybe, but she doesn't want to sew anymore. She doesn't want to have anything to do with what they consider old-fashioned sorts of activities. So we have to glam up fashion again so that people want to work in fashion.
You can see, like, for example, as a Brazilian living in London, I heard, for example, that Bon Marché in Paris, they did a big thing in Brazil.
They did.
Do you have other projects of that, like selling Brazilian clothes like in major department stores, in not only in Europe, maybe across the world?
Yeah, before Le Bon Marché, we had this big project with Macy's in the United States. I really can't reveal names right now, but we have two major projects on track with France again and Italy. We have also been stores from the Middle East and Asia because, I mean, Brazil is going to host the World Cup. Brazil is going to host the Olympic Games. So it has a story behind it. And people are really interested in knowing what Brazil really is. People know about sports. People know about summer and beach. But it's interesting for the department stores, too, to have this story behind them. And then, yes, we have many things going on, many things under negotiation. And we're totally open. Abit has been the main executor of the Le Brésil Rive Gauche, which is the project with Le Bon Marché. And we're very open to other opportunities. The only thing we ask is that people don't use Brazil as a marketing tool, but that they actually buy Brazilian products and let their customers really experience what Brazilian products are and really be able to wear our lifestyle.
And finally, Velazio, how would you say is the special thing about Brazilian fashion comparing to other major markets?
Brazil is such a huge country. I mean, we're a melting pot of barely all the cultures in the world. I mean, we have the largest Japanese community outside Japan. We have a huge Lebanese community. We have a huge Polish, Italian, German community. So I think Brazil has an approach to fashion that talks to everyone. I mean, we're really democratic when it comes to fashion and design. And also Brazilians have a really strong approach to the body and to aesthetics and to beauty. So I think what we have to offer to the world is that relationship we have with our bodies. That is, it's not only about building gorgeous bodies, but about cherishing what you have. If you're not like a perfect size zero, you can also be really stylish and sexy. So I think it's that we can communicate with everyone.
And that was Ivelacio Miranda Costa there speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier. Now, last night, the King of Belgium spoke to his people live on television and resigned. Albert II has said he's going to step down and hand the job to his son, Crown Prince Philippe, in 3 weeks' time on Belgium's National Day.
Now, he's blamed health problems for his decision, which comes 20 years after he first took on the role after the death of his brother. The Belgian monarch's role is largely ceremonial, but King Albert's time on the throne hasn't been entirely free from controversy either. Shortly after he took on the job, he was embroiled in a scandal over an alleged child out of wedlock. So is the Belgian royal family in good hands now? Well, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson is in Brussels for us, and she joins us on the line now. Charlotte, abdication seems to be rather de rigueur at the moment. What's been behind this, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. We had Beatrix in the Netherlands in April who stepped down, and of course the Pope as well, who abdicated over his health. So in Belgium, however, it's not quite so common as it is in the Netherlands. Queen Beatrix's mother and grandmother had both stepped down in favour of the younger generation. But in the whole of Belgium's history, an abdication has only happened once before, and that was not a voluntary abdication. That was during the Second World War. So the king last night, in his speech to the nation, he laid out that his age and his health were the key reasons why he had decided to relinquish the throne. He said that no other monarch in Belgium's history was reaching his eighth decade. The king is now 79. And he spoke of the need to bring in the next generation of royals. It certainly hasn't been the easiest reign. He's been really challenged by an increasing political divide between the French-speaking south of Belgium and the Dutch-speaking north. And there's a lot of talk that this has really drained him. He's found this a very tiring situation, and this may have contributed to his decision to abdicate.
But Charlotte, he did say it was because of his health, but there has been some speculation in the media that it could be because perhaps of a controversy surrounding a court case being brought forward by a woman who's claiming to be his daughter.
Yes, that's right. This happened a few weeks ago that a Belgian artist called Delphine Bol, she has asked the court to demand that the king and two of his three children, including Crown Prince Philippe, give DNA samples to prove her claims that she's a product of an affair that the king had allegedly had with a woman in the 1960s. Now, while he was on the throne, the king would have been shielded from that court case because the constitution says a sitting monarch can't face legal action which would interfere with his duties. So there had been some speculation when the case first became public a few weeks ago that this might hasten the king's decision to abdicate. it had already been discussed that he was considering it, but this could have sped things along a little.
Charlotte, I wonder, a place like Belgium, about whose sort of complicated national sort of makeup we hear so much, and who's been through such sort of difficult political process in the last few years, does that mean that the monarch, this sort of super political figure above it all, is particularly important to them? Is he a unifier?
Yes, absolutely. Many people think that the Belgian monarchy is the only thing that really bridges that divide between the two sides. King Albert, despite the controversies, has always been a popular figure. He's very jovial and chatty, and people have seen him as a uniting figure, and certainly during the political crisis here in 2010-2011, when Belgium went for more than 500 days without a government, he stepped in. He used his position to try and help bridge those divides, and they did come out of that crisis. So all eyes are really now on Crown Prince Philippe to see whether or not he can maintain that stability. He does not at the moment have the same levels of popularity as his father. He's seen as a little awkward, especially with the media, and there are some fears that it might not be quite such a smooth path with Prince Philippe at the helm.
Charlotte MacDonald Gibson there in Brussels. Many thanks for joining us on the program.
So in the next half hour of today's Midori House, we're going to head to Australia to discuss the return of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. We'll see what's made today's front pages. A little review from Tom Edwards is coming up. And we'll talk about the importance of placemaking in our communities.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
First up, Barney Burnham. He's here with your headlines.
Thanks, Dom. The Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been ousted by the army and is being detained in a military facility in Cairo. In a televised announcement, the head of the army said Morsi had failed to meet the demands of the Egyptian people. The White House says President Obama and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel have agreed to hold a high-level meeting on allegations that the US has spied on its European allies. In a statement, the White House said the two leaders had spoken on the phone and US and EU officials could discuss intelligence and privacy issues as early as next Monday. Filipino activists in the capital Manila have marched on the US embassy to show their opposition to plans to grant American troops access to a proposed new naval base. The military is planning to build new air and naval bases at a former US base to allow America to keep a close eye on Chinese military movements in the region. News Corp has defended its boss, Rupert Murdoch, following the release of a secret recording in which he criticises British police and their inquiry into allegations of phone hacking by journalists. He's heard complaining to Sun journalists about totally incompetent police officers, and he describes the inquiry as a disgrace. News Corp said Mr. Murdoch had shown understandable empathy with his staff. Authorities in Peru have brought criminal charges against developers who destroyed an ancient pyramid at an archaeological site near the capital Lima. The building, which is one of 12 at the El Paraiso complex, was thought to be around 4,000 years old. The director of the complex says those responsible have committed irreparable damage to a page of Peruvian history. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. No more speed eating news, clearly.
I guess we're all full.
Barney's full. Thank you very much. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn. Now, last week, Stockholm played host to the Future of Places conference, the first in a series of events leading up to the UN-run Habitat 3 conference in 2016. The Urbanist was there, of course, to report on this three-day forum of academics, mayors, architects and others, all there to discuss the intricacies of a decades-old approach to city building, placemaking.
And you can trace the school of thought back to William H. White, who was the first to study how urban spaces he'd plan actually worked out after they'd been built. Well, this was 40 years ago. It's also been around then that the project of public spaces was established by Fred Kent. Well, urbanist producer David Michon met up with Kent to set the scene and define the term he's so keen on promoting.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them. It's natural, it's organic, it localizes, it creates ownership, it creates a sense of pride, and it enables people to have lives that are more fulfilling and happier. And it's an amazing idea because it is so powerful. The words express that, and the outcomes that we've seen show that it can have an enormous impact.
By the way you define it, it's a process that's essentially always existed in cities, but now you see people at this conference kind of, you know, self-styling as placemakers, and you know, people who are mayors or property developers or academics calling themselves placemakers instead. What do you think the impact is of all of these people kind of then labeling themselves or labeling the process?
Well, I think it can have both a positive and a negative impact. The positive it is that they're talking about it and they're being able to say that these are important values to draw out of a community. The negative is that they can begin to think that they're doing it instead of the community. And a long time ago, we know an awful lot about public spaces. We worked in, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cities, 3,000 communities, 43 countries. I mean, we have been all over the world. And I have to say, the more places I go, the more humbled I am by the expertise of people in the communities. If you just set it up for them to talk in a somewhat structured way, not too structured, but a way where they begin to see how much they really know about their community and then how much they can kind of envision what might happen. It takes a little while and it takes kind of what we call a placemaking exercise. But as they begin to realize that they know a lot and that they have a lot of good ideas, and it's not someone else that they have to go to get the ideas from, that they have them themselves, and the other person that they're talking with also has ideas, and together they realize that they really know something. And once they know something, then they feel like they can act. And then they get rewarded, because by doing something in what we call a lighter, quicker, cheaper way, they can be rewarded very quickly. And it's that sacred process that is so, so important. It can be taken away in a heartbeat, and someone can come in and say, I'm a placemaker. Like, there's this terrible word called tactical urbanism. Well, what does that really mean? Well, it means that someone professional is going to come in and do something that's going to create urbanism. Well, most people don't like the word urban, and tactical is kind of a jargony word. Well, just think about lighter, quicker, cheaper, and what you can do tomorrow so that a little girl who's 5 years old can barter her toys on where in front of where they live. You know, that's a lighter, quicker, cheaper. That's helping to create a place. Everyone can do it. And when people start segmenting it out and saying that it's professional or something like that, then, or it's even collaborative. I don't even believe the word collaborative is a good word. It is community-based. They own it, and they create and define the outcomes.
Now, as the concept of placemaking kind of gains a bit of force, there's a risk of it kind of becoming a buzzword. So how do you kind of rein that in? How do you make sure that placemaking maintains the kind of meaning that you would be comfortable with?
Well, there's so many organizations or disciplines that like to create their own language. And I think if we can keep it as a normal language, like we don't use the word urban, we don't use the word smart growth, we don't use the word transit-oriented development, we don't use any of these words that have outcomes. We don't even use the word park, because we're looking for places that people want to be in. That's all you just keep saying. And everyone can ramp onto that in a way where they can feel comfortable. And if you maintain that, and it's a precious word, it means that to them, they own it, and they can become, they can receive amazing benefit by just participating in that kind of activity.
Just to think about, you know, you talked a bit about kind of the importance of community ownership over projects and urban development or development in cities. But speaking from kind of a top-down perspective, in from Bloomberg's perspective or Amanda Burden, you know, the people who are at the kind of top of City Hall, what use does that have for them then? How do they interpret placemaking, and how can they kind of incorporate it into their working lives?
Well, placemaking for these top-down leaders is not in their lexicon. They have not used that idea or understood the idea. The Bloomberg administration has been a very top-down, highly professional set of organizations that really don't talk to each other. The various agencies do not talk to each other at all. And they have not been able to engage with the communities. They've tried to do large-scale, big projects that have never gotten the community buy-in that they want. But as a result, because they've been focusing on relatively few projects, the whole city has transformed itself through local placemaking, lighter, quicker, cheaper, neighborhood by neighborhood. We live in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is just an amazing energy, highly exciting, diverse. Things are happening that change. You go down one street one day, and 3 days later you go, and there's something that's changing, and something that's improved, done by individuals around kind of a collective effort to make their places better. So that's what's happening to New York, but that's below the radar screen, and the government is operating at 30,000 feet rather than 1,000 feet, and new governments can be place-based, and they can nurture that within the community and encourage that to happen.
I mean, to some extent, is it even maybe a positive thing that the Bloomberg administration, you know, has operated at a very high level, and that it's allowed almost people to, you know, they've kind of done it out of necessity, and it's produced something that has been transformative for the city.
Well, you could say that, and I like that in a way, because I have a lot of respect for the administration and what they've done. But what they've also done is, in a very heavy-handed way, kind of sterilized the whole waterfront with sort of these green swaths and perched wetlands and sort of very limited use types of spaces that don't really re-energize the waterfront. I mean, if you take New York and it's New York City and its waterfront, I would put it maybe number 70 in terms of great waterfronts. And I've been all over the world looking at waterfronts. And what they're doing now is not getting any better. It's just more passive. It's almost suburban type spaces done by one narrow discipline, landscape urbanists, that isn't really creating the diverse destinations that people really crave.
What do you think is the best approach for city governments then to involve kind of the lower, kind of the lower echelons of, or the community-based organizations, without taking them over?
Really, it's about working with local groups, local people, and helping them to understand that they have a major say in what's going to happen, building their capacity through exercises, and then finding ways to better listen, and then to do what we call lighter, quicker, cheaper. And it's that lighter, quicker, cheaper where you can start doing things. And then as the community sees the impact of that, they begin to think about doing more, but they also begin to think about bigger, and they begin to think more holistically. And government can pace themselves with that, because no matter what happens, they have to be in sync with what that community wants. And helping them to get in sync is part of a government's job.
That was Fred Kent there speaking to David Michon for this week's special placemaking edition of The Urbanist. And of course, you can hear more reports from the Future of Places conference in Stockholm. Tune in tonight at 1900 hours London time.
And for the moment, you're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this. We're heading to Melbourne to find out what Rudd's been doing.
It's that time of year when Monocle's mighty July-August double issue hits the newsstands with a glorious and satisfying thud. It's the issue where we name the best cities to call home, meet the people who know how to run a good metropolis, check out the businesses that care about more than profits, and also find a few dustier, grittier places that you should know. Here's what our editors have lined up for you to enjoy on your lounger.
In the affairs section, we make a timely visit to Istanbul to analyse the government's controversial plans for redevelopment. We meet five mayors and governors making a difference from Perth to Nairobi, and we choose our City Hall dream team.
In the business section, we head to Bolzano in Italy to find out about a family-run Forge 10 lighting pioneer recasting the region's street lamps in a chic new light. We head to the lush, leafy streets of Bandung, where a cluster of smart universities, a cadre of young entrepreneurs and a pleasant urban climate is propelling a culture of Indonesian innovation. And we join the crowds at Hiroshima's confectionery fair to find out about Japan's sweet tooth.
In the culture section, we visit LA's Brushfire Records, the almost zero carbon record label home to Jack Johnson and Bahamas, where quality of life meets great music. We'll also embark on a Monocle media survey led by quality of work as well as beautiful spaces from London to Copenhagen, not that far admittedly, and Zurich to Jakarta. Ah, that's a little bit further.
The July-August issue of Monocle also includes our inaugural 68-page food and entertaining guide and a 24-page Rio de Janeiro survey. It will keep you content with content all summer long. It's on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
It's 17:44 in Melbourne, 8:44 a.m. here in London. It is to Australia we're heading, though, to check in with our man there.
And our man indeed is Monocle's Patrick Pittman. Patrick, welcome to the show. Let's start things off with the return of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. Is the excitement, is it a return of Kevin 07? Is it now Kevin 13?
He hasn't made the new T-shirt as yet, but I'm guessing Kevin 13 isn't quite as catchy, but we're probably going to get that soon.
Okay, well, what's the latest on his, you know, we've watched this sort of soap opera unfold, some more enthusiastically than others. The prediction, presumably, was an enormous bounce in the polls. Has it happened?
It has, yeah. The first week has seen them back on level pegging in terms of preferred prime minister with Tony Abbott, the opposition leader. Now, that probably won't hold for too long, but Rudd has certainly hit the ground running. He's established a new cabinet, and he's making all kinds of changes on the ground. And suddenly, it seems like we actually might have a bit of a fight on our hands in this election.
So what's the sense there in Australia? Obviously, reshuffled the cabinet, the most women ever in a cabinet. Is there a real sense from Labour backers and pundits that Kevin Rudd could potentially win this election?
Look, they're saying that in public. I think what they really think is that they're just going to take it a lot closer than they otherwise would. The early polls are probably doing as well as they could have expected for that first week, but really the Liberal Opposition Party are probably still in the driving seat when it comes to election. But a lot of it will hinge on when Kevin Rudd does call the election, because he has signalled that it won't be held on the date that Julia Gillard had called it for in mid-September. I think he'd like a little more time to get some traction.
Okay, and lots of time to do some pretty fundamental housekeeping. There's lots of talk of reform to the Labour Party. What exactly does he say is needed, and what's he going to do?
Okay, well, today he's made some pretty huge announcements in terms of the way the Australian Labour Party works. Traditionally, it's been controlled by some pretty strong factions in the states of Victoria and New South Wales, and the New South Wales branch of the party is quite notoriously corrupt and has been for some time, and that was one of the big issues in Labor's polls earlier in the years, with some criminal charges going on there. Now, Rudd has actually stepped in and said the federal party is taking control of that branch, and they're aiming to sort of root out from the bottom up all the corruption and cronyism and such that goes on in that branch. That's something people have been trying to do for decades, and he's saying he's going to do it. So that will be huge regardless of the election outcome for the future of the party.
And Patrick, one of the issues that has really dominated the political scene there in Australia for quite some time is the government's relationship with asylum seekers, so-called economic migrants or boat people, for example. The opposition leader, Tony Abbott, has a very different view to what it seems Kevin Rudd does. And now Prime Minister Kevin Rudd is off to Indonesia to perhaps discuss that very issue.
Yes, well, the opposition's policy going into the election is that they will stop the boats. Now, that it seems like a big thing to do, and they haven't really said how they're going to do that, but one of the main things they've said is that they'll literally turn the boats around when they get into Australian waters and send them back to Indonesia. Now, Indonesia have said they wouldn't be that thrilled at that kind of solution. So Kevin Rudd is up there for his first intergovernmental talks with President Yudhoyono up there, and the issue of what they can do in terms of a regional solution for the issue is something that'll definitely be a major one on the table for the next couple of days there.
Patrick, looking again briefly at the election, if we can, the return of WikiLeaks to the ballot box, they're going to be involved. How involved will they be?
Well, the registration officially came through this week, and they're going to contest Senate seats in three states. Now, the way that the Senate elections work here, you only need to get a small percentage of the votes to actually get a seat in the Senate. So they do stand a very good chance of taking the seat away from, say, the Green Party or something like that. And one of those seats will definitely be contested by Julian Assange as well, although we don't really know how he's going to campaign from that.
And another issue, moving away from the election, though, this time, Patrick, is Australia taking on Japan when it comes to whaling.
Yes, now this has been going on for years. Australia has been a very vocal critic of Japan's so-called scientific whaling program, and successive environment ministers and fisheries ministers on both sides of politics have done a lot of work in the International Whaling Commission to try and get Japan to reel things in. But this week, they're before the International Court of Justice in The Hague in a quite landmark attempt to have the Japanese program declared unscientific and to prove that there is negligible scientific benefit to killing 1,000 whales a year to figure out how whales die.
Patrick, thank you for running through the stories that are making the headlines where you are in Melbourne. Patrick Pittman there is our man in Melbourne.
And we're going to have a flick through this morning's British front pages in just a moment with our news editor, Tom Edwards, who is waiting in the wings, ready to come into the studio. But before we do, here is a Little Joy, Stop, Play Moon. And that was Little Joy there with Stop, Play, Moon. And our next guest, he's a bit of a Little Joy, isn't he?
That's good.
Yeah, you like that?
Well, I mean, maybe not today. Tom's glaring at us. Mr. Tom Edwards is Monocle 24's news editor, of course, and he's our paper reviewer this morning.
Hi, Dominic, and hello, Phil.
Stacked grumpily in front of you. Where do you want to start with
Let's start with the
sour-faced paper review.
The Times of London, who've got something about the Time Lord.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
Doctor Who. Okay. They've got an interesting little thing on. It's their kind of page three, you know, the fun feature.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm all about fun features. There's two strands to this story. One is that Hollywood wanted to make a Doctor Who movie, and they wanted to cast Michael Jackson, apparently. That's Paramount.
I'm sorry, that's
that wouldn't have worked out well.
That's broadsheet third page random story generator,
exactly.
Isn't it? Michael Jackson, Doctor Who, Hollywood.
Well, no, but you see, Dom, there is a context for all of this, because yesterday Prince Charles was visiting the home of Doctor Who, which is apparently in some, where is it, some small place I'd not heard of, Cardiff?
Okay.
Not quite sure where that is. But he visited, and he was, you know, he pretended to be a Dalek. There was all sorts of japes going on. One thing that was quite funny, though, and this is what a lot of the papers here in the UK have focused in on, he wore a crudely repaired suit jacket, Prince Charles. Apparently, he's a lover of thrift. I don't know if you can see here. I'll show you this. Not elegantly repaired. Mm. Basically, just a big...
There's
patch
a,
on
it's
it.
A highlighted bit pointing out. It's a bit like those celebrity magazines who point out cellulite. Look at his poorly repaired jacket.
But apparently he makes virtue of this, and he's very thrifty, and he's very proud. He wears his suit.
But he must have like a royal tailor now, or is he getting Camilla to do it himself?
Himself?
Herself? Well, some might argue.
This is a confusion over
Camilla. Right, right here. but apparently he's got a pair of shoes that he is very proud they're going to last. They're going to outlive him, his shoes.
Quite right. Wow. Given that last week everyone was complaining about how much they cost, I think it's entirely reasonable that you should be thrifty in public.
Shall we have a marginally more serious story?
Yes, please.
This is something that's interesting to... You know, we do a lot about urbanism and urban design here at Monocle. There's a story about a good old-fashioned English wrangle on the South Bank in London. Most of our listeners all around the world will know of the famous South Bank.
Indeed.
Hubs, all these big cultural institutions. There's a right old dust-up coming, though. Nick Heitner, who's the director of the National Theatre, is very...
Upgoing director.
I think not for a year or two.
Oh,
perhaps.
Okay.
But he's written an angry 3,000 words, no less, to one of their neighbours, the South Bank Centre, who are going to try and build some big glass box thing on the top of their building. He's not happy.
I see.
And it's turned into a good old-fashioned English set to.
I mean, he does do indoor theatre. The National is an indoor theatre. What's his problem? It's on the outside of someone else's building.
He specifically said he's worried about his theatre-goers emerging at the interval for a beverage on the terrace and being confronted by structural beams and supports.
I think he's trying to control a bit much. What the people see and do in the interval
I feel some sympathy for him.
And to coincide with that, just down the road at Battersea Power Station today, they're breaking ground on that new multi-billion-dollar development. Of course, the iconic Battersea Power Station, famous for the cover of Pink Floyd album. So that's some good news. At least that's going to...
Well, they're going to protect it. They were saying at one point they're going to have to tear down its iconic chimneys.
Yeah.
They're going to be all right.
Give us... Have you got anything more positive and jolly?
No, this is more depressing.
So it's going downhill towards the end. Okay.
Apparently, children in this country, I say this country, particularly in Wales, this piece focuses on, I don't know why again, are getting scurvy and rickets. Now, most people would think that was, you know, that went out with the era of high seas piracy.
It's a Victorian problem, surely. Well,
at the latest.
Yes, exactly.
But no, apparently not, particularly in the Rhondda Valley. An increase in both diseases because parents rely on poor food, takeaways, microwave meals, and children aren't going outside anymore.
What's wrong with the Welsh? What's happening with
them? I think they're a weak race. I don't know.
Yeah. So they've got... The producer of this show is Welsh, I should point out.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. But yeah, big problems. Obesity. It's apparently it's worse than the days of wartime rationing.
I see.
Back with a vengeance. Rickets, scurvy. Scurvy causes joint pain and a swelling of the gums.
Wow.
Oh, delicious. Very painful.
Well, very quickly, Tom, you've got an animal story. You know, you love the animal story.
Yeah.
So let's,
what's the animal least likely to be found at the top of England's highest peak?
A giraffe.
Pretty unlikely. Octopus. You've been looking, haven't you?
I saw the picture.
Cheat.
They found a whole octopus.
Right.
A common cephalopod lying on the top of Scaffold Pike in Cumbria. No idea how it happened. They think it was an eagle's lunch and it dropped it.
Hang on, they're still calling it a common cephalopod. I'd say it's an extremely rare one,
it is. It's
surely
pretty uncommon. I didn't even get onto my rat extermination story.
Shame. You'll have to imagine that one, dear listener. Tom Edwards is our news editor and today our paper reviewer. Thank you very much. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. A Welshman, Thomas Lewis, was its producer. Its researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Connor Fitzpatrick. Chris Fitch was its studio manager. Culture with Rob Bound is up next.
And I'll be back with Sophie Grove tomorrow for Midori House at the same time, but from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.